Blog Talk Radio.
T minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5. All three engines up and burning. 2, 1, 0, and liftoff.
Coach on Fire Radio.
Fire the Tire.
Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to the Flourish and Thrive radio show. My name is Kate Hartley, and I'm your host on the Flourish and Thrive radio show, helping you live your best life possible with a selection of inspiring and uplifting interviews from people who have dug deep, been brave, and have followed their dreams, and are now turning their dreams into reality. Flourish and Thrive is designed to be your seed of inspiration, to motivate you to realize that your dreams truly are within your grasp. Whatever your experiences, whatever your background, whatever your current life situation, you can harness your resourcefulness to live your best life possible, and that means to flourish and thrive. Don't let life pass you by. Jump into the driving seat, fulfill your dreams, live a life of purpose and a life of contribution. My guests bring a combination of inspirational stories, strategies for overcoming roadblocks, and proof that when you go for gold, you usually find it, so that you, our listeners, can live your best lives possible. For more information on me, the services I offer and the articles I write, you can find me at flourishtherapy.co.uk. I hang out on Twitter. If you do a search for flourishtherapy.co.uk, you'll find me on Facebook and Twitter at Kate Hartley UK. But tonight, even more importantly, I'm about to introduce my special guest, Nicola Labori, who is here to inspire you and to educate you. Nicola is a world-renowned and successful photographer and shows how self-belief, passion, and courage can lead to self-fulfillment. He uses his photography to raise awareness, document, and tell stories which explore emotions. He is a commercial and art photographer as well as a filmmaker, with work published and exhibited worldwide. Nicola is passionate about living in the present, living a life of meaning and using nature and art to inspire people through his photography. Originally from Paris, he's now based in London. He's photographed royals, celebrities, and recently using his photography to highlight subcultures and how they are perceived within society. His photographic career is rich, varied, and noted for his supremely creative flair. He has been selected 2 years in a row for the Passion for Freedom Art Award and was part of the winning film in 2015 for directing it. His solo wet plate collodion exhibition is currently running in London at the GX Gallery in Camberwell. He is also part of a touring art show in China. He has been selected for the last 2 years for the London Art Fair and Affordable Art Fair in the UK and New York. He has been the cover artist of State F22 magazine and featured in various other magazines. He has just published his first book called Tin Tribes in the Garden of Ether, a photographic art book of unique wet plate collodion images about subcultures, but with an important message, which is also a quote from Oscar Wilde: be yourself, everyone else is already taken. So we're going to be talking about overcoming life's challenges, the importance of finding motivation in life, the importance of making the right choice about whether to abuse or appreciate your situation in life, and how vital it is to own your own decisions. So Nicola, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Kate, and thank you, and good evening to everyone. Bonsoir.
Bonsoir. So to get us started, Nicola, I wonder if you'd share with us what got you started with where you're at now.
Well, I mean, what got me started is very much a change that I needed to happen because of the way society and especially technology was going. I mean, with the world of photography, everything is going very fast. You know, digital media now happen that every time we take a picture, we'll see it straight away, and we want to take so many pictures all the time that I feel like we're missing the importance of your subject, what is on the front of you. And so I needed to kind of find myself to slow down and appreciate it more. And so I did my research, and I was always been interested in the history of photography, and I wanted to actually put myself in going back years and years ago in 19th century to start this technique, this historical technique, which allowed me to start from scratch. You create your negative, you use a very simple box and a lens. And everything, for me, it's a bit like meditation. So you're really slowing down, and everything you do, a bit like mindfulness, if you want, you really appreciate every moment. Appreciate because they're dangerous chemicals as well, so you have to be careful. But I think by doing that new, well, that technique, it's not a new technique, but that technique, it really made me appreciate more what I was doing, what I was creating, and how I saw things around me.
Yeah, I think it's so important to become more mindful because we all live such busy, busy lives. And I really like the fact that you have completely slowed down how you perceive the person in front of the lens or the situation in front of the lens, and how you've kind of brought that mindfulness into your career, your perception of how photography should be. So, talking about mindfulness for a moment, Nicola, what do you think mindfulness brings to your life?
I mean, mindfulness has changed a lot of things for me. I mean, not only in the creative world of photography or any other media, but as well because of my jobs I had, my career that I had before, which is in catering, which I'll come back to that in a minute. But I know that I was living a very fast life, and I still do, but it's one thing for me was very much important was not necessarily to slow down my life, which is, in a way, things happen for reasons, and things happen and you have to move with how the world is fast running. But it was all about taming the mind. I think for me that was the most important thing, which I know a lot of people will always say, well, I need to change my life, and they quit job and they do this, but they don't necessarily find happiness. For me, I needed to understand how my brain works. And at the same time, I realized that one of the key solutions for me was mindfulness and meditation. So it's changed a lot. And even when I shoot my commercial work in digital, instead of doing 2,000 pictures or 200 pictures you would normally do, I do much, much less because I've learned to communicate more. I learned to appreciate more what happened, but always working within a deadline, if that makes sense. And I think it's a lot to do with attitudes, and it's changed so much about the way I look at things in my life and in my career as well.
No, so I was just going to say, when you talk about your attitude to your career and your life, how would your attitude now be compared to how maybe your attitude was 5 years ago, for instance?
Well, 5 years ago, okay. I mean, the one of the important things that seems to always occur in creative environment is the competition aspect. Everybody want always to do better, and there was always this attitude of, well, if you can do it, I can do it, but I'm going to do better. And there was a certain aggression towards the way the creative world I was in was, but I don't look at it that way at all. I think that anybody who is in the creative business should embrace each other in a sense where I get inspired by other photographers, I get inspired by other artists. I get excited when other artists I know do well because once I realize they work hard, and there's no, I personally don't think there's such a thing as when people say, oh, you're very lucky. I'm a great believer that the harder you work, the luckier you become. So it's a lot to do with hard work. And the other things as well is we, I very much believe in the family aspect of, you know, all creatives should work together. And I think it's very, very, very important to be able to see clearly exactly. And we're all different. Like you said in the quote on, earlier is we cannot compete in this way because we are all different. We have different skill, different style, and we look at things differently. So that's needed to change in my mind, because I know that it became quite vicious and venomous and dangerous in that way, to be able to work with other people who kept on being competitive. And I needed to do something different. And I think it's easy to point fingers at other people, but eventually it's really down to you to be able to look how your mind processes things, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. And I really like the fact that you say it's so important to be part of a family, as it were, that you support each other, and that you willingly, happily support other photographers and other creatives in your sphere. Because, for instance, out on social media, it's so important if we all work together rather than against each other, because then we have a much more cohesive whole.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, social media is a good example. I mean, I never thought of going into the social media world for quite a while, until I was convinced otherwise. And I'm a great believer, if you do something you believe is the right way, but it doesn't work, be willing to change and be willing to try something else. I mean, you've got nothing to lose. And that's the attitude I had. So I decided, okay, I was pretty much against certain social media, and I thought, well, you know, I'll try and see how it works. And actually, things have changed for the better. I was able to connect with other people, which I admire. I was able to talk about other people. I mean, we're coming back about being in a family. And the thing is, you know, as an artist, I'm also a collector. And so for me, I appreciate and I love art. So when you see something beautiful, it's normal. When you see a flower, you want to smell it. When you see something beautiful, you want to express your emotions towards it. And art is exactly the same thing. So I think it's important as well to be able as well to create that world you want with beautiful images, let it be art, music, or any other medium. But I think...
carry on, Nicola.
No, I was going to say, by doing that, you create a family. That was my important. That's what I was going to say.
Yeah, I think you're right on it there. Can I just ask you about, with going back to the meditation thing? I know you've become involved with Buddhism over the last few years. Mm-hmm. Can you expand on that? How that's enhanced your life as you live it right at the moment?
Well, I mean, Buddhism. I mean, I study. I was always been interested in religion. And I thought personally that the best way was to go and study, you know, pick up the books and have a look at that, whether it's the Torah, the Quran, the Bible. I was very, very curious. And eventually there's one particular text which really got me. And I think it's the way Buddhism looks at the mind. Because for me, the mind was probably the most... enigmatic things I kept on going into, and I just wanted to try to understand better. Luckily, close to where I live in London, there's a Tibetan Buddhist center. It's a community meditation center in Bermondsey, which I went. It's open to everyone, Buddhist and non-Buddhist, and I really thought, well, I'd like to go and check it out. And I went there, and without even speaking to anyone, I remember going there and sitting in the sofa, and I just felt relaxed already. And I was thinking, wow, nothing is happening yet. What's happening? And then you go through those colors. There's colors everywhere, and everybody's happy and smiling and everything. And I thought, well, I need to know more about it. So I took a course, and it was a three-day course. And then from the three-day course, everything changed. You know, you start reading, you start looking at it. And one of the most important things for me, I mean, apart from being curious in the first place, the one thing always got me when I read all the books in terms of religion, everybody has their say. And there's a certain feel of following it. And the one thing I must admit I really enjoy with Buddhism is Buddha himself, as a teacher, always used to say, you know, I will tell you, I will give you teachings, whether you follow me or not, it's your thing. But if you know better, tell me, I'm open. And so for me, the fact that there was always a quest of learning, or constantly learning and questioning, was so important for me because I was at that stage. So I went, and then we're now talking many years ago now, because I took refuge. And from the moment I took refuge, which is a kind of an important part to affirming that you want to follow the teaching in Buddhism, I just look at it differently. You know, it teaches you so much about ego, about letting go, about the person, about what is concerned enemy, stranger, friends. Mm-hmm. So much about yourself, about bodhicitta, which is the loving kindness. There's so many different things. And the one thing I realize is about you. In order to get better in the world, you need to sort yourself out. And for me, obviously, there was a lot of anger for past life and things you think, well, I should be doing this way and not that way. And then until someone come along and just show it in a different way. I think that was for me the most important thing. And it just makes, I don't know, it changed for me, it changed the way I look at other people. And there's no, you know, you let go more. I think that's the most important. I think letting go is the most important. And I think the more you let go, and I'm talking about detachment, there's less suffering, you know. There's less chaos in the mind.
Yeah, less chaos. And when you let go, you kind of, what does it go with the flow? Or do you have more faith in destiny? Or what do you mean by let go particularly?
Well, I mean, you never know what's wrong the corner. You know, I think you can think a lot about it. But for me, there's one quote, if I may give a quote, but there's one quote that Malama, which is my British teacher, once told me, and I thought it was just the best thing ever. He said to me, if you want to be sad, live in the past. If you want to be anxious, live in the future. And if you want to be at peace, live in the present.
And I love that.
And that's for me, it's from a Chinese philosopher in the 6th century. But for me, that means everything. And that, for that moment, someone really got me to stop and start thinking. Because I, you know, although I do a 19th century technique, you know, I do think about the past. But I now look at the past in order to embrace it, what's happened in the past. You know, you think about your past relationship, your past life, you know, whether for me in France or in London or around UK, and you're attached to certain things, and your emotion gets the better of you. And yet you never understood why it's always carry on, you know, that pain of I'm missing someone or what have I done, regret and everything. But as soon as you let go of it and you live in the present, whatever is happen, you cannot change that. Whatever will happen, well, you can not change it, but you can prepare for it. And so if you have a right attitude, let's say I go for a job tomorrow. I remember there was many times where I used to go and very stressed and anxious, I would say, about going to jobs. And I always put to myself as an excuse, it's okay. That means you really care about your job. But actually, sometimes it cannot make you uncomfortable because there's a physical pain as well as a mental pain. But if you let go of it and let go of any anxiety based on so-called films in your head about what happened in the future, which actually don't even know what's happening in the future because we don't, then if you leave now and if you say, I'm going to walk into something and I'll really enjoy it, then that's what matters. And, you know, before going on air, I mean, if it was done many years ago, I would probably have been very, very anxious and not be able to talk. And I think for me, the difference is because there's an opportunity, there's a moment which I'm sharing with you and everybody else, and I want to enjoy it. And so I'm trying to calm my mind as much as possible to say, it's here, it's now, it's happening. And I think that's, for me, it's important.
Well, I think those few sentences that you've just said there are what we should all try and employ in our lives on a daily basis, because it is so important to live in the present moment. And anything that we might be afraid of in the future is just a perceived threat. We like you say, we have absolutely no control over what might happen. And I operate very much upon a basis of living life for the very moment. So we live with no regrets because you just don't know what's going to happen. A roof tile might fall on your head when you walk out of the front door, or that bus might run you over on the way, you know, on your way to work. So I really admire the fact that you've managed to take so much, it's almost like relinquishing control in order to have control over your present day life.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I remember by going to teachings, and I'm not, you know, teaching's been very important for me, but there's a lot of other people around who's been very important. But, you know, I look at my lama and things happen in life and, you know, people passing away and everything. And in the face of death, I remember one person asking, you know, how does he feel? And he always said that he wants to be able to be content, because if anything happened, then he could say I was happy.
Absolutely.
And I think I'm discovering, and it's another world out there about dealing with death, because death is an important part in the circle of life in Buddhism. But, you know, even me, I'm still coming into terms with that. But and there's still things I need to learn. But at the same time, I keep on thinking to myself, you know, I've changed my life in order to do what I want to do. Not because I needed to, but because I wanted to do it because of a passion inside me.
Mm.
And so anything goes great, I will appreciate. And if it goes bad, then I should say to myself as well that, well, I'm lucky, I'm doing something I want to do. And it's going to be good days and bad days, but I'm actually doing something for me. So when I look back at, you know, death and bad things happen and everything, there's part of me thinking, well, you know, I'm content, you know, and if I was not content at this at the time it happened, then I should be working harder, you know, to find myself content. Not because I just need to accept it's happening, but it's just because I think you can only, if you live fully, then when anything happens, you just say, okay, it happened because of this, because of that, and you can always find a solution, as opposed to feel blocked or feel cornered, you know, because I truly believe always a solution on that.
There is always a solution, and I salute you for your philosophy on that, Nicola. I just want to break the interview just for a moment, because I want to let listeners know where they can find you, and also to give them the guest call-in number, just in case anybody would like to call in and ask Nicola or myself a question. So to find Nicola, first of all, you can find him at www.nicolalaborie.com, and I will spell that with him being French. It's NicolasLabori.com. You will also find that on the Coach on Fire Facebook page. You can find him at twitter.com/Nicola_Laborie and on instagram.com/Nicola Laborie. For anybody that would like to phone in and join our very interesting conversation, we'd love to hear from you. You can dial 646-716-7979. Again, 646-716-7979. So pick up the phone and get in touch with us. So, Nicola, you were just chatting then about making choices, and that you have you make the choice to either appreciate life or to let it negatively affect you. So, is that as a result of you having become more sort of closely related to Buddhism, or is that something you fostered yourself throughout your life up until this sort of current moment?
No, it's been a never going learning curve prior to me taking refuge. The process, I personally think, I can only talk for myself, but personally I found the process got clearer when I took refuge. But it's through teaching and through meeting other people who can show you other ways, and it's very easy when you're having a bad time or you're questioning yourself to be one, to close yourself in and say, well, I'm not going to go out until I find out what's happening. Or to go to people who will always say to you, don't worry, you're okay, and you know, you just need a rest, and you know, the usual thing. And so for me, it was important to detach myself from those type of comments and people, and to go to people who don't have any idea of my background or where I come from or who I was or anything, but took my question and gave me advice purely on the now and then. And so for me, teaching were the best way to be able to work with myself, mm-hmm. on myself, in order to help others or ever to understand better others. So Buddhism, yes, it plays as a great, great part for me. For me, it's very important. As much as I meditate on the morning and the evening, I think it's, and if I don't, if I miss a meditation, I it's not that I don't feel bad, because I don't want to attach myself to a feeling like that, but I feel like something is missing. And I'm very aware that I just need to come back. And sometimes I would do it in the tube if I don't really have the time. Even a 5-10 minutes helps me a lot.
Okay. Do you just to sit there silently and clear your brain, or how do you meditate?
Well, at the beginning, this is all I needed. All I needed was the most quietness room in the world. I quickly realized that it was a small mistake that many do, I think, is that because if one day you're in a situation and there's noise around you, it's easy to admit defeat and say, well, I'm not going to do anything. It's not quiet here. So I've learned very quickly by a group of people, actually. I remember they were doing flash mobs all around London, and where we just give a day to time and we all go there and meditate all together, and people on walkers and tourists and anybody could join in, and some did. But I remember one day we were in Covent Garden, and it was very busy, very noisy, a lot of people drinking, and we stayed. And I was amazed, because that's when I realized that you can meditate in the midst of chaos. If your mind is relaxed and you control your mind and your emotions, then everything else should be just background noise, if that makes sense. So now I found the tube very easy to meditate. It's easy to block, and it's come back to state of mind. It's come back to kind of block what's around you, and without missing your stop, of course. Because that probably happened to me a couple of times, but it's true. I mean, it's one of the things you just got to think about. But and funny enough, once I remember that there was a gentleman who woke me up to say, well, didn't wake me up, because meditation is about being awake. But he bumped into me and he say, "Your stop is finished." And I say, "Oh, it's okay. I'll do it again," because I want joy. There was a moment I enjoyed my meditation. I wasn't going to work. I was going just in town to check some museum and everything. So I really enjoyed that. And sometime, well, it happened once when I just did the journey again, just because I enjoyed it so much. but you look at it, it happens. It happens sometimes. That's the thing. You can enjoy it so much that you just difficult to not do it again, basically.
So the message to our listeners should be, get your meditation thing going. If you don't do it, start it already.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if I would give a message, I think meditation should be, and I think should be proposed very early age. You know, we always see children as the future, and it's true. Children are the future, and we always look at them, you know, growing up and have no cares in the world. But actually, very early age, they are sponge, so they're absorbing everything that's happening, you know.
I think we should introduce meditation in schools personally.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's very important. And I know in America and in a couple of other countries, I've started to do classes at the morning. I know in the police in Denmark as well, where people take 10, 15 minutes to meditate before they start a meeting. I know some companies do that. And it works absolutely great. So my first thought will be doing that. And the people who thinking about meditation but not sure, I would say the one thing always happened, and it happened to me. Sit down, you think you're going to close your eyes and go and sleep and all this. And I've first 2 minutes, not even a minute, I freaked out. I suddenly starting to have like what it sounds like a panic attack. And I thought, wow, what's happening here? And I thought, no, I'm not going to do it. Meditation is not for me. Thank you very much. I didn't leave. I actually didn't leave. I stayed, opened my eyes, and I watched everybody else doing. And then I went to my teacher, and I say, you know, I cannot do it and all this. And my teacher says something to me, which is very, very simple. He say, look, your mind is like a waterfall. You know, you're just realizing what's happening. You know, you didn't take a picture. You lift it. And so I was starting to think about what he was saying. And, you know, he was talking to me about a lot of images, like, you know, you would take a glass, an empty glass, and you fill with a sea, you know, with the sand, with everything. And he said, look at the glass, and the glass will be all mucky and everything. And he said, this is your mind. If you don't touch the glass, the sand will go down, the water will be clearer. And so at that stage, I'm starting to realize, okay. And the second thing he said to me as well, he said, this is not a competition. You're not competing for anything. You have all the time in the world. So slowly I thought, well, I try again. And I tried 2 minutes and then 3 minutes and 15 minutes and so on and so on. And that's what I realized. I realized that at the first time when I meditate, my mind was so busy that all it was like a reality check to see how my mind was working. So I thought it was me trying to, I thought I was the effect of meditation, but it's not. You're just relating. So I would encourage people to keep on going if the first time was not the best time. I did, and it's a great, great benefit.
I love the fact that you say it's not a competition too, because I think, you know, meditation is almost like the buzzword of the last decade, and a bit like yoga too. You know, it's become, there are so many different varieties that you can do, and it's almost like, yeah, well, my meditation technique's better than yours, honey, so, you know, I'm going to do mine. And I think, you know, we get to the stage where it almost puts people off who don't meditate or who are afraid to approach meditation because of the perceived competition that's out there, because there are so many varieties, and some people are, you know, they're really good at it and good for them. But I think it's really important that we can kind of encourage people that haven't yet embraced meditation just to take up that sort of morning or twice daily ritual of just enabling their mind to clear, because it makes life so much clearer.
Absolutely.
Moving forward, you know, it does help you overcome challenges, and I think it's really beneficial with the decision making process as well.
Absolutely. I think we're into a world where we need to label everything. If you have something not right in your body, you have to put a label. It's this, it's that, it's cancer, it's this, whatever it is. And so we're used to it. And meditation and yoga, it's no stranger. People need to, and there's people who go and say, oh, what type of meditation you do, what type of yoga and this and that. But eventually, for me, I don't think it's that important. I think as long as you understand what you're doing, as long as you understand how to do it as well, and what is the principle of what you're doing, in the way is right, then it's fine. I mean, a simple breathing technique can be translated into a meditative state later on, you know, just listening to your body and your breathing from the nose to the belly. And suddenly you can, it's a start up to a Shinya meditation, for example. So there's many, many ways people can do it without saying, well, I've got to cross my legs in a certain way. You know, crossing your legs and everything, there's a purpose for everything. But the one thing is, for me, I mean, I was very lucky because I didn't go to a meditation class per se. I went to teachings and lectures because I wanted a teacher not to tell me, cross your legs, close your eyes. I wanted a teacher to explain to me, why do I need to close my eyes? Why do I need to fix a point? Why do I need to cross my legs and have my back in a certain way? Because in that way, I knew that if I have, out of all the techniques, if there's something wrong, then I can focus on that. It's the same as going to a car. I mean, there's a reason why we learn about the engine of a car before we buy a car, is because once you have it and there's a problem, you know where to look at the problem. So it's a similar thing. And yoga is the same thing. I had a really good teacher And one thing I remember she used to always say to me, you know, yoga is more than just the exercise as such. Your exercise needs to start with the mind, the soul, the food, what you eat, your approach. All those elements are very, very important. And I, you know, I went to yoga classes where I sweated a lot and I left and I felt good. And then, you know, a week later, I didn't feel that great. And I think that's what differentiates you between real teachers and people who will just open the classes for everybody to come in without much intention other than just teaching you without really the basis of learning, really.
Oh, a very, very profound point. I like that one. So that you think there's a big, big difference, and I agree with you, between teachers just open the doors to give a lesson against those but in contrast to those teachers.
Absolutely.
That teach you yoga and the whole ethos as to why you should be doing yoga.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, it's the same with my practice. When I look back at my practice, because it's an old technique, working with chemicals, a lot of people do workshop, and it's great because what it does, it promotes the practice as much as there's a lot of people who are doing yoga and promotes the practice, and the practice is fantastic. But eventually, I think for me, what is important is having someone who knows, for example, my practice, someone who knows chemicals. Mm-hmm. I went to a teacher in Manchester. He knows exactly what it's about when it comes to chemicals. I could ask him anything, a recipe or anything, the reason why, if I put more of this, what happened to him? He will know exactly. There's a difference between other people who learn the technique and they do it all and then go and then you see, you create an image and it's great. Thank you very much. And yoga is the same. Very, very lucky. Got a teacher and she knows everything and more. And I think it's about a service as well. You know, when you teach something, you do more than just giving a curriculum and say, this is how it works. It's a way of life and understanding, question. You know, come back to practice of Buddhism, because I question often, so I want to be able to have answers. And that's, I think, is very, very important. Anybody who would try anything new needs to question in order to understand better, because we're all different. You know, we have different needs and we learn in differently. You know, some people are fast learner and some people take a bit more time. We have different body shape and heart conditions and body physique and everything. And that as well is an important. It's understanding first before teaching, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. As you're a very creative and inspiring photographer, and I don't mean that to the detriment of other photographers, but I've seen some of your work and it truly is very, very inspiring. What emotions do you draw from when you are composing an image?
I mean, it's so much. I'm very, very lucky. I mean, I get to work with other people. I mean, I know the photographer has that importance, you know, but for me, I mean, the people I get to meet all have their stories. I worked on a project recently with a lot of people, and it was amazing because everybody came to the studio, and because that technique is a slow technique, I get to talk more as much as I get to do my chemicals, but you still get to look at people and talk to them and listen to their story. So for me, every time I'm seeing someone, not necessarily through the lens, but as well for the chemicals, it's just there's so much emotions, and it depends on the subject matter and the person I go. Because often what I would do is I will choose, if I do a personal project, I will choose someone in connection to that project. But even when I do commission portraits, I try not to know too much about a person until I get there, because I think I don't want to pre-assume an image for that person. And sometimes the person would want a different emotion, want to give me a different emotion. So there's all sorts of emotion going through. And with the technique of wet plate collodion I do, because the image are all made of silver, and it's a long exposure, it's almost like stealing a soul, you know, it absorbs so much more of the face and the eyes and everything else. So it accentuates the emotions, if that makes sense.
Definitely. And can I ask you, what out of your sort of photographic career, just sort of bring it back to how it's affected your life. What would you say, is there an individual or a certain aspect that you've photographed that's had the most permanent and impressive impact on your life? Was there something that you photographed that kind of was a defining moment for you?
Well, I hope not. I hope not, because I think if I had a defining moment, it's very easy for my mind to say, well, I may as well retire now. Which I don't want to. I don't know who said that, but I think it was a photographer who said, I'm yet to take the best picture. So I believe that. I think that everybody I had the privilege to meet and privilege to take picture of, I enjoyed it. There is pictures who are being more popular than others because of the person that's been represented and because of maybe the time as well. Maybe it was the right time and everything. But you know, I mean, I can always think of my first picture I did on Wet Plate, or I could think of my first cover magazine. You know, all those pictures are important, or there's certain images which had a very important because of the I wanted to raise awareness in certain ways, and you know, I got nominated for certain things. So there's certain pictures, yes, but it's really much an experience. I mean, I know a lot of people when they come and they have their portrait in Wet Plate, they see it as an experience, but for me it's an experience too, because I get to create with them from scratch a negative, an image. You know, and how to explain in ombre type, it's an image made from wet plate collagen on glass, and ombrotos is the Greek word which means immortal. So for me, that's what it is about. It's creating immortal, you know,
a moment of immortality.
Exactly. So for me, all those moments are very, very important. So it's very difficult to say one person more than the other. Apart from those moments I presented, just because obviously it's part of my career, but I would not want to say that I've got a best picture more than the other. And I still think I've got a lot more to offer. I hope so.
I'm sure you've got an awful lot more to offer, Nicola, and I'm looking forward to seeing what your next projects are. So, for people listening to this, what would you recommend a resource that everybody develops within themselves to help them cope with life and to make the best of their life? Just one resource. What would be your key?
I wouldn't be nothing with other people around me.
Okay.
Whether it's family or whether it's friends. And I'll never forget. It's something I'll never forget. And that's for me, I think that's the thing I will really think about. But that's personal. Now, for someone who has no one, someone who consider himself or herself to have no one, well, see, the problem we have is the only thing that we can see, I'm trying to imagine myself as with no one, is all we see in front of us is strangers. And I always just think that strangers are just unnamed friends, you know, friends who have not been any name yet. So it's very easy to not feel alone if we want to have friends, if that makes sense. You know, it's easy, just a question of open up. So, I mean, for me, friends and families are the best thing, because they, you know, give me a reality check. They're there when I'm good and then I'm not good. And, you know, for me, it's all part of the same person. I don't have anyone who just want to be there just because it's all going well. I just don't think it's exciting, you know. But I think it's difficult to say, because I think for me, that's the most important. It's very much the people, the world around me, you know.
Connection.
More, oh, absolutely. And especially the fact that the more we run, the more things happen so fast, news happening every second and everything. I think it's important to not forget what's around you. Because we, if you imagine yourself standing, all we see often is what is in the horizon. Because we've been told, you know, this is your target. But I think that looking what's underneath your feet is so important, because you won't be able to make that journey to that destination until you know how to take the first step, you know.
Very good point.
It's so important. And I think that's the one thing we take for granted all the time. You know, you look at technology, you look at people on their phone every 5 seconds and forget about it. And you go to a meal and everybody's on their phone. And you know, loved ones who leave us, and then suddenly you're like, well, I wish I did that. And I don't believe that. I really don't believe that. Not so long ago, I called a friend and I say, how are you here from city? Didn't even excuse, I just say hi, you know.
Yeah.
I just wanted to see that person. You know, I don't have to wait until someone give me an excuse to see that person. You know, it doesn't have to be a private view for a show or a meal or theater or film or anything. Even if it's 5 minutes, even if it's a hug.
It's so true. As you know, I work in hospice sometimes, and one of the top regrets of the people who are dying there is that they didn't spend enough time with their loved ones, just doing, being with their loved ones, not doing anything in particular, just being and expressing their love for each other. And it's so important to live in the present and appreciate each step that we're taking in this funny, strange little life that we're all living.
Absolutely.
And to surround ourselves with friends and family, be connected.
No, absolutely. And open yourself to others. I mean, I remember I did, if I may quickly say, I remember doing a project on cancer. A friend died, and everybody grieves in a certain way. And for me, I didn't really have the time to grieve properly because I was starting that project. And I found myself in a home, and people were excited. They wanted to meet me, and it was 5 minutes, 10 minutes per person taking your picture, and that's it. I didn't do the 10 minutes, take your picture, and that's it. Spent a whole day, spending about an hour and a half with each person. I took the picture was probably 5 minutes, but I took an hour and a half. I must admit, I was drained at the end. I was lucky because I had a recorder with me, because it allowed me to switch off sometime. And I just listened to people. And that was the moment where, for me, I realized that I was grieving as well. Because people are, their life, I mean, they have cancer, you know, they were going through it. Some had weeks, some had years, you know. And that's when I realized that life is precious, because you've got to open up to others. You know, they were strangers for me. But I was lucky enough to be able to be there to listen to them. And I think sometimes that's a big thing I've learned, is sometimes listen, you know.
Yeah.
You know, cook a meal is great for someone. Someone is down, just go and cook a meal. Just be there. Someone wants to have a rant about a bad day, have a go at me. Punch me if you want. I mean, you know, I'm a very much like, I enjoy that moment, because it takes away, that's detachment and let go. You're practicing it for yourself, but as well, you allow others to do it. And that, for me, was very, very important. So that's, come back, you know, there's families and friends, but there's other people as well, that sometimes if you can just spend 5 minutes to listen to someone, you might find so much about you, and they might appreciate it in the way as well.
Yeah, I always say we should use our ears and a mouth proportionately, and we have two ears and one mouth.
Yes.
I think if we all became better at listening,
sure,
we would
sure.
be in a very happy place. Sure. And so can I ask you something? This is a question that I'm going to ask all of my wonderful guests on this show. So what would your 80-year-old self advise your current self to do now?
What my 80-year-old self?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a really good question. I like that.
Thank you.
I don't think my 80-year-old self will be much different, hopefully. He probably would say to me, eat better and run more. I think he will probably do that. And I think the second thing he'd probably say is, yeah, I think that's it. Eat better and learn more. Or he probably would say, I told you so, because I'm still here at 80. I think that's it. But I don't, you know, I'm really, age, you know, it's not something I look at. I mean, I remember when I got 40, because everybody talked about 40. It was just another day. I know people around me who didn't see it that way, but for me, I embraced it. And I think because it was such a big moment for a lot of people, it made me want to do it more. It made me want to do more and more and more. So I have less fears that I used to have. I think my 80 self will say, look at those fears you have. They're silly. I think that's what he probably would say. I mean, he will probably take the Mickey out of me, because it would probably make me appreciate that if I was thinking ahead, there will be a lot of things I would take out. But I don't have any regrets. You know, I don't live with regret. So I live purely on trying to enjoy every moment. If I'm 80, that's great. I must admit, I'll be very happy, you know.
Yeah, I think we should all celebrate if we manage to get to the ripe old age of 80.
Well, my grandmother is 101, so hopefully
you've got good genes in your family.
Oh, she's amazing. I mean, she is amazing. She never worked a day in her life for any boss apart from herself. She's a steely, steely woman, and she's still here.
Good for her. So what's her secret to success, apart from obviously having pretty good genes?
She's an amazing woman. She's amazing what she's done. I think she's her own boss. I think the fact that she's someone who always say, I do what I want, I think it's a good startup. But she went through a lot. I mean, you know, she, during the Second World War, she lived in a farm all her life. And during the Second World War, the occupied Germans came, living just next door, and they threatened her many times. And she never had anything to do with them. She say, that's my house, I do what I want. And, you know, she was threatened with guns and violence and everything, but she never. And I think the beauty of it, and the person at the time, the opposition, if you want, at the time, saw a stillness and somehow grew a likeness of her. So they had a relationship, you know. She was a farmer, he was next door with his unit and everything. And somehow they, you know, it obviously is war, so it's a very difficult time. But she's always stayed true to herself. She hired a British pilot once, but she never gave him up. You know, and it's things like that for me that just amazing woman. Oh yeah, one day I remember a man coming to the farm, unannounced, didn't speak a word. He came, sat down, cup of tea, talked two words, and he left. And this man is a man that was rescued by my grandmother, hidden in a house, and every year he used to go to the house just to have tea with her. And just to say a bit of a thank you without talking. And I never talked to the man. You know, I speak English. The guy is English, but never spoke to the man. She told me once he left. She said, he just come once in a while. Like it's nothing, you know.
And I think that's goodness.
I was amazed. I just couldn't believe when I saw it. But it just showed that my grandmother doesn't need anything, doesn't want anything. But she just remained herself, and she worked through all the difficulty and adversity in life and everything. She's in a nursing home now, but she still, you can sometimes see her, and she still wants to, you know, bust people around a bit, you know. And I think that's the secret. She's just a steely woman, and I think it's a lot to do with the mind and, you know.
Yeah, and I think it's very much, she's a woman of her own mind and making her own decisions for herself.
Absolutely, and the mind is powerful. You know, coming back to Buddhism, and that's one thing that always it fascinates me is the mind is such a beautiful, powerful tool. Can make or break anything. And I think that's what she has. She has a steady mind.
Well, on that very positive note, we've got about 5 minutes remaining of the interview. So are there any last-minute thoughts or inspirations you would like to leave our listeners with?
Well, my last thought is enjoy every day as it comes, you know. Especially now, I think now it's an interesting time when there's a lot of change, and obviously no one likes change, good or bad. So I think that it's the best time to be united. I think people need to be more together, not only with themselves, but I think with other people. I think it's the best time to be able to call people, you know. I mean, that's probably my message. Just call out, you know, just call other people and say, hi, how are you? You okay? Don't let regret happening, or don't let things happening. You know, I look at the state of the world at the moment, and I know a lot of people are angry with what's been happening, and some of them are out of their hand, but a lot of things could have been manipulated better if we had more say or more things to do. So I think we need to stand up for ourselves. And that means as well in her life. I think, for me, I'm lucky. I just had a show. Well, I've got a show is happening at the moment. I've got a book. I've got everything happening. And I think the one thing I know, and I keep saying to myself, is tomorrow it will be gone.
Yeah.
And so I need to enjoy it now. Because I cannot enjoy it later. It's too late, if that makes sense.
So tell us, how can we see a copy of your book?
My book, you can see it online on my website, nicholaslabory.com, without the H, Nicholas. On social media like Twitter and Instagram, I often put a lot of pictures out there. Otherwise, they can go to the gallery, which is GX Gallery in Camberwell. The show is until the 3rd. There's a copy of the book over there, and they can see original plates. So it's a one-off images made with the wet plate collagen process.
Yes, that's what I loved so much about your wet plates is the fact that they are just completely one-off, unique, individual photographs, and they are never, ever going to be replicated again.
Absolutely, and I think that's the thing about my work, in my artwork, which are really important to me, is the sense of uniqueness, whether it's the subject matter, whether it's the work on itself, or the book. The book is limited edition. The prints are limited edition. So for me, it comes back to the way I look at things. I think that it's a short moment that we need to appreciate more, as opposed to have done an open edition where, oh, I can look at it later, and, you know. So I think that's the point I see as well in life. In life, it's easy to just think, well, I can deal with that tomorrow. But we never have the sense of, actually, we need to appreciate when it's there. So that's the important for me, is that when I work on my tintype, is they are unique. They are one-off. I don't take the same picture twice. And it happened, and you create it on the front of everyone. So that's the beauty of it.
That's what I love so much. So basically, in essence, be unique. Watch each step forward that you take and do it with mindfulness, and make sure that you connect with those around you and love your loved ones and make friendships and just keep connecting and making the world spin on a very happy axis. So we're coming up to our time, Nicola.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today. It has been such a delight and such a pleasure to have you on here. I can't tell
you
how honoured I feel that I got to interview you. And I'm just really excited to have the opportunity to connect with you. And thank you for all the value you've provided to our listeners. This was episode 1 of the Flourish and Thrive radio show with Kate Hartley, and you can find me at flourishtherapy.co.uk. Nicola Labory was my inspiring and beautiful guest, and you can find him at nicolalabory.com. So go out there and live your best lives as though today was your very last day, wishing you a life of integrity, honesty, and inspiration. And until next time, goodbye for now.
I can do anything, I can reach any goal today. I can do what I want, I can be what I want to be.
Fire Radio.